Twice this season, the television news magazine 60 Minutes has run a segment on Alex Honnold, an unassuming young man who scales sheer vertical rock faces with no ropes and no safety equipment. Nothing but a pair of climbing shoes, some chalk dust, and his bare hands. Hundreds of feet in the air. The footage of his climb on 60 Minutes is amazing enough that I actually watched it a second time. You can still find it online on the internet if you're interested. At times, the cameras above him were focused down on the dizzying distances below, and the very tall trees below him looked like grass. That's how high he was in the air. As I watched this last time with Meredith, my daughter, she asked an interesting question. What does he do when he gets to the top? And it's an interesting question because it's actually more difficult to come down than it is to go up. In fact, as Alex climbed, a commentator pointed out when he passed the point of no return. The commentator explained that after that point, there was no turning back. There was no way back down. He had to complete the rest of the climb up that rock face. So what does a climber like Alex do when he reaches the climax of an effort like that, the summit of a rock face hundreds of feet in the air? Well, the reporter did give us the answer. He goes down the other side. After the climax of this feat, there's always a 2 or 3 hour hike down the other side of the mountain, the easier side of the mountain. It's rather anticlimactic. We see this same thing here in Romans chapter 3. Let me explain what I mean. Some Bible teachers believe that verses 21 through 26 here in Romans 3 comprise the greatest explanation of the gospel in the Bible. As paragraphs in the Bible go, this is a towering mountain peak. The paragraph closes with the great thought that we have considered the last few times that we have been here in Romans. We are justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth as a propitiation by His blood, through faith, to demonstrate His righteousness, that He might be just and the justifier of one who has faith in Jesus. Now, as the Apostle Paul reaches the summit of this mountain peak, he doesn't stop. After reaching this literary climax, there are 5 more verses here in the chapter. And to put it bluntly, these 5 verses are anticlimactic. I mean, what we have in these 5 verses is Paul, as it were, going down the other side of the mountain. And as Paul goes down the other side of the mountain, he turns around, as it were, and looks at that mountain peak from a different perspective. You see, it's very natural that we look at the plan of salvation from our perspective as human beings. When we understand what our sin deserves and how God sent His Son to bear that just wrath, that eternal wrath on our sin, our hearts are thrilled. I mean, we saw that this morning. And we should be. We have good reason to worship every Sunday. We have good reason every day to get on our knees in in our prayer closets and thank God for what He did. As sinful human beings, it's natural. It's good. It's wonderful that we respond to the plan of salvation from our very human perspective. But there is another perspective. God's. The other side of this mountain, the other perspective. Now, this perspective actually begins in verse 26. From God's perspective, He had to remain just and righteous while at the same time finding a way to take sinners and declare them righteous before His law. And I won't go back and rework how He did that. It's explained there in verses 21 through 26. But in verses 27 through 31, there are three further issues with the plan of salvation from God's perspective. So let's read these last five verses here in chapter 3, and let's see if we can discern the three issues that concern our God with regard to the plan of salvation. Beginning in verse 27, Romans 3. Where is boasting then? It is excluded. By what law? Of works? No, but by the law of faith. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. Or is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also the God of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also. Since there is one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith. Do we then make void the law through faith? Certainly not. On the contrary, we establish the law. Now, if you didn't see these three points as we read the text, you can see them reflected in the major points in my outline in front of you. First of all, the plan of salvation must give God alone the glory. The plan of salvation must give God alone the glory. Verses 27 and 28 concern boasting. Where is boasting then, Paul asks. As we look back up the summit from this other side of the plan of salvation, up the other side of this mountain, the first thing that Paul points us to is this issue of boasting. Now, we need to understand that the verb that's translated boasting here is often translated to rejoice. It's often translated to glory. The same word is used in 1 Corinthians 1:31. He who glories, let him glory in the Lord. He who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. So God is concerned with this issue of boasting or glorying. You see, God is determined that He shall get all of the glory and the honor for the plan of salvation. And Paul here is talking about the plan of salvation. You notice there in verse 27, he uses the word law twice. He speaks of the law of faith and the law of works. What does he mean by the word law when he uses it that way? I mean, is the law of works, is that the law of Moses? Is that the Ten Commandments? The law of faith? Law of faith? We need to realize that Paul uses the word law with a great deal of flexibility in the book of Romans. There are several times in the book of Romans when Paul uses the word law, and it doesn't mean the Ten Commandments. It doesn't mean the Pentateuch. It doesn't even mean the Old Testament. Paul uses the word law at times generically to mean something like a principle. So here he's talking about the principle of faith versus the principle of works. Or we might translate it or paraphrase it, a plan. Paul is talking here about the plan of salvation. Is it a plan of works? Or is it a plan of faith? And here is God's concern with this plan, the plan of salvation. When men think of their salvation, God wants to make sure that they rejoice in Him, that they rejoice in Jesus Christ. You can write it down. If a man believes that salvation comes to him, if he believes that he's going to make it to heaven, if he believes that he is going to get to know God and have God's blessing in any way that causes him to boast, then that is not God's plan of salvation. Paul says it is excluded. That's how Paul puts it here in verse 27. That statement is very strong in the original language. It's shut out once and for all. It's out of bounds. Very strong. It's the idea that God will not have it. It's unthinkable. So you get the idea here that Paul is trying to get across. God is determined that all glory for the plan of salvation will come to Him and His Son and none other. Now, let me make some comments here now that we've gotten the main idea that Paul's trying to get across here in verses 27 and 28. First of all, we need to admit that this kind of boasting is common for human beings. I mean, this is the rule rather than the exception. I mean, I think the Apostle Paul here, when he talks about boasting, was thinking of himself. Paul uses the word boasting a lot in his writings. Because I think Paul looked back to the time when he wasn't Paul, but he was Saul. And he was a practicing Pharisee, the strictest sect of the Jews. In fact, he gives us his boast in Philippians chapter 3. Let me read it to you. If anyone thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law of Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. At this point, Saul's religion was all about himself. Who he was and what he had done and what he was doing. The same kind of Pharisee that Jesus talked about in Luke chapter 18. You remember his prayer? God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. I. Boast in himself and what he is and what he's done. Now, listen to me. All religion in the world, whether it's organized religion like Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam or Mormonism, or whether it's unorganized religion, you know, I talked about the spiritual smorgasbord a few weeks ago where people kind of belly up and pick and choose what they want. Whether it's organized or whether it's a pick and choose religion, all religion falls into one of two categories. Either I place confidence in myself and what I have done and what I am doing, or I place my confidence completely in what God has done through Jesus Christ. Those are the only two choices. And by and large, men fall into the first category. Their religion is about what they have done and what they are doing. Their religion is about boasting in themselves. You know, if you think about it, it's rather amazing how religiously proud the average human being is. Melba sent me a link. Was it this week, last week? To a video, an online video that was made by Ray Comfort. You remember Ray Comfort? Ray Comfort's the guy that put out the evangelism seminars, Way of the Master. And it's always interesting, I think, to watch Ray Comfort. You know, if you've got a camera and a microphone, anybody will talk to you. And they'll talk to you for as long as you want. So it's interesting to watch him talk to people. Because almost always, when he begins that conversation, those people believe they are okay with God. I want you to think about the audacity of a person whose life is shot through with sin, thinking, God will accept me. That kind of boasting, that kind of pride, is what characterizes the average human being. And God says, I won't have any of it. It's excluded. It's out of bounds. I will not permit it in the court of heaven. The second observation that I would make here is that God is a jealous God. I mean, that's the heart of this. Twice in the book of Isaiah, God says to idolatrous Israel, I will relent. I will bring you back from captivity. I will bless you again. But I will not give my glory to another. That's our jealous God. Now, we have to admit that that concept of God is a little difficult to swallow. We worship a God that wants no one to boast in anything or anyone but Him. He wants to get all the glory from salvation Himself. And He admits that He is jealous of anything that robs Him of that glory. Now, I got to tell you, if a human being were to act in such a way, we wouldn't want anything to do with them. I mean, we run as fast as we can from conversations with boastful braggers. I mean, who wants to talk to somebody like that? You know, I heard of a conversation like that. A Texan was bragging to an Englishman about how big Texas was. He said, well, you could get on a train in East Texas on Monday morning and head due west and be on that train all day Monday and overnight and all day Tuesday, and you would still be in Texas sunset Tuesday. And the Englishman replied, well, you can do the same thing in England. Our trains are just that slow as well. We love to be able to deflate a braggart, don't we? You heard about the American who was bragging on Paul Bunyan, you know, the greatest lumberjack in history. And there was a Moroccan who said that he believed that Ibrahim Hassan was the world's greatest lumberjack. And the American's like, Ibrahim Hassan? Who is that? I never heard of him. And the Moroccan said he was the famous lumberjack of the Saharan forest. And the American said, the Saharan forest? Don't you mean the Saharan desert? And he said, well, it's a desert now. Nobody likes a braggart, do they? You see, there's a vast difference between a human being who wants all the glory and an infinite, eternal, creator God who demands all the glory. See, a human being deserves no praise or glory because anything that we have been given. If we do anything noteworthy, it's because God gave it to us. God enabled it. God permitted it. It's not that way with God. God is the source. He created it all. He sustains it all. Every good and perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights. All things are from Him. And through Him, and to Him, to whom be all glory, both now and forever. This infinite, eternal God is worthy of all glory, and particularly in the matter of our salvation. There's nothing unbalanced. There's nothing unhinged. There's nothing unseemly that this God would demand all glory in the matter of salvation. And then a third comment. This concern on God's part dictates that salvation must be a matter of faith. That's what Paul says in verse 28. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith. We conclude. That's the logical outcome of the fact that our God is a jealous God and He must have all the glory. You see, saving faith is a simple reception of a gift. You know, if I come down to Martha and I say, I'd like to give you a gift. Well, I'd like to give you a gift. And she reaches out. Now, is there anything that she can glory in for receiving that gift? No. It's just a matter of saying, thank you. So this concern on God's part determines that salvation has to be a matter of simple reception, simple faith. That's the only way that salvation could fit into the plan of a God who's determined that He will have all the glory. And in fact, I look at this concern on God's part as being very determinative of how we look at salvation and the plans of salvation and the theology that has to do with this. If we conceive of salvation, if we conceive of this doctrine in a way that permits a person to boast, then we have misunderstood the doctrine. And this is one of the reasons that I believe that God is the one who actually even gives the faith to believe in Jesus Christ. It comes from Him. It's all of Him. Therefore, He gets the glory. If faith is something that I'm capable of as a human being, then who gets the credit for that? You see, I've seen the illustration that I used a moment ago with Martha done a bit differently. I have seen an evangelist take a $20 bill and say something like this, I'm willing to give this to one of you. And then he kind of stands here with his hand and he keeps talking and waiting. And of course, what's he waiting for? Yeah, he's waiting for somebody to take him at his word and to come down and walk up and actually take the $20 bill out of his hand. Now, I'm not going to do that. I need that $20 bill. But what does that illustration communicate? That illustration communicates that if I'm smart enough, I get the gift. Well, if I'm smart enough and I get the gift, then who gets the credit? I do. See, it's kind of like cashing in a coupon. You know, I don't know how, but somehow I have gotten on the right mailing list at JCPenney. Not sure how my name got there. I'm just glad that it is, because twice a year they send me a $10 coupon on a $10 purchase. And I got to tell you, when I cash that coupon in, I feel really smart. In fact, I'm boasting to you about it right now. Do you get the idea? If we conceive of salvation in any way that we can get the credit for what's going on, then we have conceived of salvation incorrectly. You heard a couple of testimonies this morning. John said that for many years he thought salvation was a matter of the fact that he'd said that prayer. It was something he had done, something he could take the credit for. And it wasn't until he realized that it was about Jesus Christ and something he couldn't take the credit for that he really was saved. Same thing with Emily, you know. I got to say the words just right. If I say the words just right, then I'll be saved. Well, if I say the words just right, who gets the credit for that? Do you see? We have to conceive of salvation as something where God gets all the credit. That is His concern. Now, again, as Paul looks at God's plan of salvation from the other side of this mountain summit, the other perspective on salvation, he makes a second point in verses 29 and 30. And that is that the plan of salvation must reflect that there is one God. The plan of salvation must reflect that there is one God. When Paul asks in verse 29, "Or is He the God of the Jews only? Is He not also the God of the Gentiles?" The answer that he gives is that the true and living God is the God of all men. He's the God of Jew and Gentile, male and female, blue collar and white collar, Western, Eastern. Now, literally, how Paul puts it at the beginning of verse 30 is like this: if God is one. That's how some of the modern translations translate that. If God is one. Many believe that what's happening here is that Paul is referring back to the most important passage in the Old Testament for Jews of that day. That passage is Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5. It's called the Shema. Let me read it to you. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." I mean, in the same sense in which we as Bible-believing Christians today can all quote John 3:16, the gospel in a nutshell, the Jew of ancient times, of Paul's day, could quote the Shema, could quote Deuteronomy 6, 4 and 5. It's Judaism in a nutshell. But the Jew did not take that Judaism in a nutshell, that God is one, to its natural conclusion. Now you need to understand, in ancient times, the Jews were basically alone in believing there was one God. They were basically the only monotheistic, mono-one theism God. They were the only one God religion in ancient times. And so that set them apart. That belief that there's only one true and living God, creator of all things. And what Paul is pointing out is that the average Jew did not follow the logic of that. If there's only one true God, then He must be the God of all men. And He must provide salvation for all men. God is not a tribal God. He's not an ethnic God. He's a universal God. But you know, here's what I find interesting. Today, men have made the same mistake, but in a different way. Now, today, it's just the opposite of what it was in ancient times. In ancient times, Judaism was basically the only monotheistic religion. Today, it's just the opposite. I mean, monotheism has won the day, at least in the West. People that aren't atheists, people that aren't agnostics in the West basically believe in one God. I mean, even Oprah believes in one God. But believes in one God. Thank you. But believes in one God in a little bit different way. You've heard this before. Conceive of God as, you know, He's sitting at the summit of a mountain and there are many paths up the different sides of the mountain. And so there are many ways to get to God, many paths to get to God and to heaven and salvation. This is the view of one God, you know, that the World Council of Religious Leaders, the Parliament of World Religions, this is their view of that one God. But Paul says that metaphor is exactly backwards. Notice what he says in verse 30. Since there is one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith. Let me give you the Girard paraphrase of that verse. Since God is one, since there's only one God, He will justify all men the same way by faith. One God, one plan of salvation. Say it with me. One God, one plan of salvation. See, what Paul is saying here is that the idea that there are many paths that lead to God, that doesn't make sense. If there are many paths, that's a leftover, that's a holdover from there being many gods. It aligns better with polytheism. But Paul says the logical conclusion of the fact that there is one God of all men is that there is only one plan of salvation, and that is through Jesus Christ by faith. And then finally, as we look at God's plan from the other side of the mountain, Paul expresses a third concern from God's perspective in verse 31. And that is that the plan of salvation must establish the law of God. The plan of salvation must establish the law of God. You know, it seems from the very beginning of the New Testament era, salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ has always been open to a charge of being anti-law. And that's a serious charge because God's name is tied to God's law. See, if we rightly understand God's law is a revelation of who He is. It's a revelation of His heart, of His character. So you can't demean God's law without demeaning God's character. So slighting the law of God is a very serious thing, because when I do that, I slight who God is. And as I said, since New Testament times, the gospel has been charged with denigrating the law of God in two ways, in regard to how Christians live and in how Christians are saved. Now, Paul deals with that first one later on in Romans chapter 6. Where people accused him, well, if people are saved by grace through faith, well, then they can do anything they want. They can sin as much as they want. Should we sin that grace may abound? That's what Paul says at the beginning of Romans 6. So he deals with that in Romans 6 through 8. But at this point, he deals with the fact that salvation in how we're actually saved, that denigrates the law of God. And what's Paul's answer? His response here is brief, but it's very emphatic. He says, certainly not. I like better how the old King James puts that one. God forbid. The way we would put it today is, no way! That's the idea. It's very strong. It's a very emphatic word. And then Paul just sets out a very simple claim. He says, the gospel doesn't denigrate God's law, it establishes God's law. But Paul makes that bald-faced statement, and then he doesn't explain why or how the gospel establishes God's law. So we're going to have to kind of fill in the blanks here. Okay? Let me give you three ways that God's plan of salvation actually establishes God's law rather than empties it of meaning. First of all, the plan of salvation shows that God's law is so high and so holy and so perfect that no human being can fulfill it. God's plan of salvation shows that God's law is so perfect that no human being can fulfill it. Think of it like this. Suppose that rather than sending His Son to die on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins, suppose that God said something like this. I'm just going to save men the way men want to be saved. Men want to be saved by keeping my law. So I'm going to let men be saved by keeping my law. But I know that men can't really keep my law all the way, so I'm going to kind of set the bar a little lower. And I'll make the passing grade, you know, maybe a 70. Or maybe the passing grade will be a 60. Or maybe the passing grade will be a 50. Now, if God did that, what would He be doing to His law? See, He would actually be degrading His law if He did that. He would be saying, you only need to keep 50% of the law. So you get a 50, you pass. But God has not said that. He says, you have to fulfill my law 100%. God has, through His plan of salvation, completely upheld the integrity of His law. Now, let me ask a question, though. What if God had said, you only have to get a 50 on the test? Anybody going to pass the test? No. Because everything we do is tainted by sin in some way. If it's not our words, it's our deeds. If it's not it's our deeds, it's our thoughts. If it's not our thoughts, it's our attitudes. If it's not our attitudes, it's our motives. In some way, 100% of what we do is tainted by sin. We can't even make a 50% passing grade. Then in the second way, God's plan of salvation establishes the law because it executes the penalty that God's law requires. Paul's very clear about this in the book of Galatians. In Galatians 3:10, here's what he says. For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue in all the things which are written in the book of the law to do them. Paul says, look, you've got to realize, God's law isn't just a list of do's and don'ts. It also has a penalty attached to not doing the do's and don'ts. There's a curse attached. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. And God's plan of salvation exacts that penalty. It exacted it from Jesus Christ. The full wrath of God on the sin of every human being was poured out on Him. Again, think of it this way. I read this week that the South Carolina legislature is considering passing a law on home invasion. And we just saw Jeannie's uncle and aunt a couple weeks ago. And they told us about sitting in the house and their son turned around and there's a guy with a gun in the house. This is happening more and more. So let's say they pass this law. And they're considering some stiff penalties, attaching some stiff penalties to these laws. So let's say they pass a law and they say, you know, home invasion, it's automatic 15 years. So let's say they pass the law. And then let's say the next day, after the law passes, a drug addict breaks into his neighbor's home. He's got to find money for his habit. His neighbor's home, and he calls the police. The police come. They catch him there, in the house, red-handed. There's no doubt about his guilt. First guy in South Carolina to break this new law. And they take him before the judge, and they try him. And there's no doubt. The jury brings in the verdict. He's guilty. And the judge says, well, you know, this is your first offense, and this is a brand new law, so I'm going to let you off with a $300 fine. Now, has the judge established the law by doing that? No. He's undermined the law. See, some people believe that God can just say, it's okay. You don't have to keep my law. I won't exact the penalty. I'm a good God. I'm a merciful God. God can't do that without undermining His law. And God's plan of salvation does not undermine His law. The full penalty had to be exacted. And that's what Jesus Christ bore. And then number three, you've heard me talk about this before. God's plan of salvation establishes the law because the only person who is right with God's law is a person who has a perfect righteousness. We've talked a lot about the God kind of righteousness that Jesus Christ wrought through His life. And the only way that God ever declares a person right with His law is if God, first of all, takes that perfect God kind of righteousness and puts it on His account. And so the only person that God declares right with His law is the person that He has given that perfect righteousness. Salvation is not just about the penalty for sin. Salvation is also about having a perfect record before God. That's what Jesus Christ did, and that establishes fully the integrity of God's law. Now, from another perspective, what this passage emphasizes for you and me is that the law is the wrong tool for accomplishing salvation. And faith is the right tool. I'm so thankful for the testimonies that we had this morning, because they emphasize this. That if there's anything of ourselves that we think we are doing in order to be saved, that's the wrong direction. It's the wrong path. Salvation is always a matter of simple faith, simply receiving the work that Jesus Christ did, that He finished once and for all. And if you're here this morning and you're using the wrong tool, then I urge you today, pick up the right tool. Put your faith 100% in what Jesus did for you in His life and in His death and in His resurrection. You can know forgiveness. You can know salvation. Could I have every head bowed, please, every eye closed?